Welcome to Heavy Hitter Sports, where I share the inspirational stories and thought-provoking lessons from game-changing athletes and business leaders. I'm your host, Mark Hogesang. For my show, I've spotlighted several sports icons who are no longer with us, such as Steve Prefontaine, Jackie Robinson, and Arthur Ashe. However, those were host on mic episodes where I simply shared my personal thoughts without interviewing any guests. Yes, I did extensive research, and I'm quite familiar with the lives of these three athletes in particular. But it recently dawned on me that you as a listener might prefer hearing from true experts. And by that, I mean listening to family members, friends, or authors who intimately knew the featured sports legend. With that in mind, I'm thrilled to share my conversation with Cody Gifford. Cody graciously talked to me about his father, Frank, who's a true football hero. For those younger listeners who may not know, Frank was a USC All-American, NFL Hall of Famer, and a renowned host of Monday Night Football for 27 years. Of course, many of you may also know Cody's mom, Kathy Lee Gifford. At the end of our conversation, Cody and I also talk about the scourge of football, that being CTE. This debilitating brain disease has sadly ravaged the lives of way too many football players, as well as their families. Many of us avid podcast listeners cut out at the end of an episode. In this case, I'd highly encourage you to stay to the final beat, given the poignant and touching letter that Cody shares during the wrap-up. Enjoy, sports fans. Cody, welcome. Thank you so much for joining the show today. Your father once referred to football as a game of brotherhood, teamwork, and sacrifice. As his son and a former player yourself, can you talk about what football has meant to your father and to your family through the years?
Wow, what a great kickoff question. No pun intended. Happy to be on the show, Mark. Thanks for having me. First thing that comes to mind is that I often joke with people and say football built his home, right? Built our home and gave him a life. He would attribute football and his success in football and really his coaches along the way as giving him an opportunity to have the full life that he did. Homer Beatty was his high school coach who essentially plucked him out of obscurity. And when he was being a knucklehead and not going to class and in Bakersfield, California, Homer Beatty was the guy who basically took him aside and said, hey, look, you could be different. You could be something special. And to the son of an itinerant oil worker, driller, and I don't say that disparagingly at all, and neither did my father, but the understanding was that his father worked in the oil fields and my father's older brother worked in the oil fields. And that was an honorable profession and remains an honorable profession. And that was what my father was just going to do, right? School be damned kind of thing. It wasn't really a need or an expectation that there was going to be much education beyond high school.
Your father described himself as a depression baby. And from what I understand and from what he shared, he actually, as a child, lived in 47 different homes because, as you said, his father was an oil field roughneck. So they were nomads following work.
He would often say he grew up in the back of a pickup truck. And sometimes that's if they were lucky. So yes, he was born in 1930. And August 16th, he actually shares the birthday with my mom, weirdly enough. But he was born in 1930, born in Santa Monica, California. And then they know it was that number of towns because my father's mother annotated it in her family Bible. So there is a record of all the different towns, sometimes two towns in one day.
That's just crazy.
Like many people in the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, California, he had a really rough go at it. His father was constantly chasing work, and what work there was to be found was often limited and short-term and temporary. It was probably like the least stable upbringing that one could have. But my dad would always say he'd get to a new school, he'd be thrust into a classroom, and obviously there'd be no continuity of education, right? But there would be continuity on the playground and throwing a ball around, because that didn't change from school to school. That was what it was. So I think my dad found from a very early age, that was a way to basically make friends and not feel like such a loner and the new kid all the time, right? It's one thing if you're the new kid in the class, just plopped in the middle of the semester or whatever. But if you're that new kid and you can run faster than everybody and throw a ball farther. And so he found a way of becoming not such a loner, not such this conspicuous new kid every time he moved somewhere else, which was very frequently.
We're going to talk about it later on too. Your dad was the ultimate teammate. He truly cared about those that he was playing adjacent to. And as you mentioned, so he doesn't star academically in high school. He does on the field of play. He then goes to Bakersfield JC, and then he earns a scholarship, goes to USC, the school which you and your sister will ultimately then attend as well. What memories did your dad share with you about his college days?
Oh, man. So I had the pleasure and the privilege of, when I was deciding between schools myself, of going out there with him a couple times. Just walking around campus, he was sharing stories with me of when he was washing dishes at the fraternity to supplement his scholarship income. And even now, when I go back to SC, there's this sort of, it's hallowed ground in our family and for a lot of people, right? Particularly the Coliseum. But there was another story that he shared with me where they were in a huddle in practice and a baseball rolled into the huddle. And the guys looked at each other and the baseball field was however many X yards in the opposite direction. They're like, who the hell hit that ball? They said some kid named Mantle.
I think that probably leads us into talking about his time with the New York Giants, because in 1952, he's drafted in the first round by the Giants. And that's actually when he encounters Mickey Mantle in real life, because he becomes the toast of the town with Mantle. Baseball at that time is more popular than the NFL, but that's going to change. And your dad plays a key role in that. And amazingly enough, this is an era where a great athlete like your father can spend his entire career. And he does that with the New York Giants, the 12 years. And given his amazing talent and the movie star looks and the team's high profile, he really does become the toast of the town. Did your dad enjoy the limelight, or was that just something that just came with the whole deal?
Oh, man, that's a really good question. I think he was smart enough to know how to ultimately to leverage it. And I think it wasn't natural to him. I'll put it that way, because we talked about his upbringing and he was very shy by nature. And because he didn't really have a great formal education, he was very bright. I mean, don't get me wrong. He was really bright. When Homer Beatty his high school coach turned his life around, he ended up actually winning the Trojan Diamond Award at SC, which is the highest GPA. I was bummed. A friend of mine, Augusto Alonso, he won it my year. I think I was close. I was in second place. So it would have been fun to grab that.
Yeah, because your dad talks about that as being one of his proudest accomplishments, and rightfully so.
Right, and rightfully so, because there was no foundation given to him as a young man. So for him to win that award meant more to him probably than to some of the other whiz kids that fly through that program. Going back to fame and New York and all that, he was probably in some ways becoming prepared for it, right? Because he was an All-American at SC. I think it was in 51. His senior year, he was an All-American. And he was married to Maxine, who was the Rose Bowl queen. And he was on the cover of magazines. And Hollywood had come calling already at that point. He was doing stunt work for some of the major studios. And so I think he was getting more acclimated to it. And New York, talk about being in the right place at the right time, both for him personally, but for the growth of the NFL coinciding with the advent of television in the 1950s, specifically the late 1950s and in the 1958 NFL championship game against the Baltimore Colts. He always knew, too, at the time, that you didn't make a heck of a lot of money playing professional football. Like, a lot of his teammates had second or third jobs in the offseason. Artie Donovan, the guy, nose tackle for the Colts, worked in a liquor store. Sam Huff, one of the greatest linebackers in the history of the league, he was a gym teacher in the offseason in West Virginia. So it was just as different could be. And coincidentally, too, my father actually shared a locker with Mickey Mantle at Yankee Stadium, because the Giants were playing at Yankee Stadium at the time. And when there was a changing of the guard at the end of the season, they would swap, but it was Gifford and Mantle's locker. But I think my father handled the fame as well as one could handle it, coming from the background that he did. And then always knowing that football was not going to be the end all be all, and that you only have a finite amount of time that you can play it. He was already hosting a show for CBS radio while he was on the team. And I think part of that, Mark, comes from his own father and not knowing what that next job is going to be. He was never going to be in that position again. And by that time, he had three kids. He had promised himself that he was never going to have his kids be in the same position that he was in growing up, through no fault of his father's own, but just circumstances, macro conditions and whatnot. He was able to leverage that fame and really work on it. He actually saw an acting coach in New York City. He worked on his diction. He worked on his cadence. And I think by the time he had that little stint with CBS, and then he did local news after he retired. So again, by the time Rune Arledge came calling for the position opening for Monday Night Football in 1970, he had already done the legwork. He would continue working at it for the rest of his life. But that gave him the foundation to do 27 years for Monday Night, because he was always ready. You know, he knew one tear of the knee, one tear of the ankle, whatever it may be, could end the career. And then what?
No, exactly. If we go back to his playing days before he gets into the announcing world, he is arguably one of the most versatile football players of all time. Nobody ran the halfback option, which you don't see too much in the NFL. But nobody ran the halfback option better than your dad, and he still holds the record for most passing touchdowns, 14, from a non-quarterback. And I was talking to a good friend of mine who's a little bit older, who saw your dad in action during the days, and he says, and I'm believing him, that he threw that halfback option with both hands upon occasion. Just incredible.
Like Paul Bunyan, Mark, some of the stories about him, like, you got to parse through. But hey, if anecdotally, if he says he was there.
The one thing that I know for a fact is that he becomes an All-Pro at three different positions, running back, wide receiver, and defensive back. I can't even conceive of that happening in today's game. Plus, he then occasionally played quarterback. He kicked field goals. He returned kicks, back to your point of like Paul Bunyan. It is absolutely amazing. There's a moment or two within his first book, though, The Whole 10 Yards, where he talks about the versatility almost being a curse of sorts, because in a perfect world, it sounded like he would rather have just focused on one single position. Is that how you view it as well?
Yeah, the league, when he entered it, it was the tail end of whatever preceded, whatever you want to call preceding the modern NFL, right? Mm-hmm. So he really became the face of the modern NFL, but he was there in the early 50s where there was still guys doing the two platoon system, right? Going both ways, and Bednarik being one. I'm sure you're going to want to talk about him at some point, but he was going both ways. My father was toiling both ways in front of a half empty stadium at the time. I think that was the Polo Grounds, actually. And I remember, I think it was 52, 53, and my dad was just busting his ass and had been the number one draft pick out of SC and was just getting clobbered physically because the game was so brutal. Talk about safety concerns. You go back and look at some of that footage, some of the late hits. You really weren't down until you stopped moving at the time. Like the pylons were absolutely horrific, and what would go on in underneath them were just as bad. Wellington Mara, one time after the Giants, the late great Giants owner, my dad was in the locker room and he had just played 60 minutes and was not making enough money to justify what he was doing physically to his body and had needing to provide for his family. And I think Wellington came down and put a hand on his shoulder and just slipped an envelope of a couple $100 bills in his locker and just thanked him and just said, you're very special to us. And I think, as my dad put it, my dad was about ready to quit at the time because of the toll that was taking. So the question was really about, did he want to be a more specialized player? And then absolutely. And originally that was a quarterback, right? Played a lot of quarterback at SC, believe it or not. It was a completely different system. Wing T, and he, like the quarterback, he got a lot of the direct snaps. I guess we'd call it more like a wildcat today, where he was getting the snap a lot, running or passing it, and having the option to do that. And it was ultimately Vince Lombardi, who he attributes his the success in his professional game, he attributes it to Homer Beatty in high school and then to Lombardi.
He's the offensive coordinator for the Giants.
Exactly right. Can you imagine having Vince Lombardi as your OC and Tom Landry as your defensive coordinator? Jim Lee Howe was the head coach, and he was a former military man, and I guess he had enough brains to just delegate to the two of them, two of the greatest coaches of all time. I don't think there's ever been a better one, frankly, just objectively speaking, having two of those guys on the same team. But anyway, it was Lombardi who knew what my father could do offensively and said, we're wasting him, spreading him too thin on defense as well. So they moved him to halfback, and the rest is history. And my father was, you could think of it like the prototype for what Vince Lombardi then did with Paul Hornung in Green Bay. And he literally took that template and he applied it with Hornung and Bart Starr and the great offensive line that they had in Green Bay and all the championships that they won.
And it all works for your father. He becomes an 8-time All-Pro. He wins the MVP award in 56, the Comeback Player of the Year award in 62. And in total, he plays in 5 championship games. Now, your dad, from what I understand, quite modest. But did he ever regale any stories of amazing success that he looked back on so proudly?
Oh, good question, man. And he was as modest as they come. The first thing that comes to mind is his enshrinement in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 77, but not just the fact that he went in, but the fact that Wellington Mara was his presenter. That meant a lot to him. And in fact, before we jump here, I will, in the other room here in our den, we've got all of my father's trophies, and it's the handwritten letter from Wellington Mara when my dad retired the first time. So I'll go grab that at some point. I'll read it because your listeners may get a kick out of it. You'll see what I mean about why that being the presenter for my father would be so special because of the mutual affection that they had for one another. So that's the first one that comes to mind, but it wasn't about him going into the hall. It was about this great man who built this franchise, his father having purchased it, but him really, he and his brother and his family really building it up.
Yeah, because you actually don't see that in today's sports world, that close relationship between owner and player. It's a rarity. What's so interesting is not only is your father a star on the field of play, but as we've indicated, he then, once he retires in, I believe it's 64, he then starts working as a sports announcer for CBS. Ultimately, he lands a position at ABC, and that's when his second career really takes off. At the time, the wild world of sports was so critically important to sports fans, and he's a host of that. He works 8 different Olympic Games, and then, as you mentioned, he anchors Monday Night Football for 27 years. And so he's in our home every single Monday night with his partners, because that's the first time that there had been 3 people in a booth, and he then wins 3 Emmys for his brilliant work on Monday Night Football. Did he have a sense for how impactful he was in enhancing the popularity of the NFL, both as a player, but then also off the field as an announcer?
I think it was hard not to have, because there were times early on when he was with Don, who was he was my godfather, Don Meredith. But to answer your question, for those who don't know, those who are listening, with my father, Howard Cosell, and Don Meredith, and that was the triumvirate in those early years. And the popularity was so great. But you got to remember, too, there were only like 4 channels, right? There were like the networks, and there was no cable or anything like that. So you had these massive numbers that you just cannot replicate today other than the Super Bowl. But you were hitting whatever it was, 1/3 of America. The numbers are just stratospheric. And when the 3 of them would roll into town, it would get so crazy that fans outside the stadium sometimes would rock their limousine.
Oh my gosh.
And you got to think the security infrastructure was also not what it was now in the 70s when you got Joe Buck and Troy Aikman going into MetLife to do a game or whatever it was. And it's just a streamlined, oiled machine. They were building the plane, right, as they were flying it. And it was, my dad always attributes, again, there were these men in his life, and men and women in his television career, he attributes his success predominantly to Rue Knarledge, who was the mastermind, who saw what it could be, and who, in working hand in glove with the commissioner, Pete Rozelle, at the time, who saw that Monday Night Football was going to be an extension of the weekend, and putting cameras on the sidelines and putting cameras in the locker room and using people like my father and like Don to maybe the chagrin of somebody like a Howard Cosell, who comes from the more traditional journalistic path, using guys like Don and my father who could get access to players and who could get players to open up to them in ways that they would maybe shrug and give a stiff arm to somebody like Howard and say, get out of my face, particularly after losing a game, right? Yeah, I think they knew, I think maybe it was probably the first time that their limo almost got tipped over. They knew that what they were doing was striking a nerve.
For today's sports fans, it may be almost hard to envision, unless you grew up with Monday Night Football, how impactful it really was. And it wasn't always the teams or the players. It really was the magic that was happening in the booth. And today, not to be critical of Jack Buck and Troy Aikman, but they're announcing a game. People are not tuning in to necessarily see them work their magic, because it's just more rudimentary. Whereas there was a certain sparkle, magic, and almost to a positive degree, attention within the booth, because clearly Meredith and your dad were far different than Howard. Somehow Arledge saw how that trio could work. And although there might be awkward moments at times, it definitely did work. And it made people tune in. It was must-see TV. It was TV magic, unquestionably. And then what's interesting, because your dad does work the 8 different Olympics, and one of my favorite moments, and I think this must be in your household as well, your dad is on mic during arguably the most exciting event ever from a skiing standpoint in Olympic history, Clomer's downhill race in Innsbruck in 76. That has to be fun to rewatch at times.
Oh, it's one of my favorite stories. It's 76 and they're in Innsbruck, Austria. And Franz Klammer is the hometown hero. Mm-hmm. And his competitors have gone before him. And he knows what his time to beat is. He ends up running what is now universally regarded as having one of the greatest downhill runs of all time, if not the greatest.
Yep.
Because he just fly. And you can watch it. The film is still widely available. And the guy is just flying down the mountain, almost to the point where an inch here or there, and he was just going to fly right off the mountain. He's going down with reckless abandon.
He's on the edge.
They're on the edge, exactly. And he ends up crossing the finish line. The time comes up, and my father's calling the race with Bob Beatty, and he gets the gold. He wins. And it's this miraculous moment in the history of sports, in the history of the Olympics, and in the history of that town, and for the hometown hero to win the gold. And it's just this tremendous moment. And I think my father and Bob got a little carried away because they thought they had recorded the race, and then they got swept off in the bedlam and in the excitement of the moment. And then they end up going and having a few schnapps with Franz Klammer and his retinue and all the people. And one of the producers comes, presumably at the tavern or whatever it is, and taps my father on the shoulder after however many drinks and says, "Frank, we got to go back and we got to re-record the audio." My dad looks at that person and says, "What the hell are you talking about?" And he said, "Because of the way they were broadcasting, they have the video, they have the visuals, but they need to go back and capture the audio one more time." Oh. So after a few pops, as my father would put it, they go back into the booth, and this too is widely available on YouTube, and you can hear how animated they are. And Bob and my father were able to put together what then subsequently became universally regarded as one of the greatest sports broadcasts of all time, where my dad and Bob were calling the game almost retroactively, right? Knowing where it was going, but not being able to show their hand. And they were able to pull it off. I don't know how many takes it took them to do it, but then they won some award for it. I think it was an Emmy that year too, for best live broadcast or whatever it was, ironically, because while the race was live, their recording of it certainly wasn't. But
see, I had no sense for that.
Yep, absolutely hysterical. And my father would, even up until the end of his life, would laugh about that. And then he would get a little smirk and said, "Yeah." And the drive home was even more interesting. Of those snowy valleys, whatever the elevation was. I think Bob was asleep in his lap or something like that.
Your dad was also a very generous man, and he was one of the founding members of the Special Olympics. How did that come about?
That's a really good question, Mark. And I truthfully don't know the genesis of it. I know it likely had to do something with the Shriver and Kennedy connection. My father was very close with the Kennedys, and then later on with Bobby particularly and Ethel. And I know they were heavily involved in it.
It must have added to the athletic nature of Special Olympics to have such a renowned football star, personality, celebrity, yep, also endorsing and backing and fueling the energy towards the Special Olympics, which is just amazing. And the impact that it's had over the years has been phenomenal.
Yep. No doubt about it. And we've got a photo here in the basement, a great one, where my father's there with Arnold Schwarzenegger and a number of these other luminaries all supporting the cause, and what an amazing cause it is and continues to be.
If we switch gears a little bit and start talking about you, your dad is 59, actually, when you're born. And your mom was also a celebrity, Kathy Lee. So your birth made national news. I remember it from a distance. And
sorry about that.
You had two amazing parents, but how was your childhood? How would you describe that?
Childhood was great. Certainly my father and to a large extent my mom, they endeavored to keep us out of that, my sister and me. And they wanted us to be as normal as possible. Because believe it or not, my dad was actually a very private person. It goes all the way back to those years growing up in the back of a truck, not really trusting strangers too much, being shy by nature. I think that's probably why he's a little bit of yin and yang with my mother, and maybe why they opposites attracting a little bit, because my mom is just an open book. She really wears her heart on her sleeve. And I think that's why she has had the success that she's had with her fans and viewers, because she's so honest and vulnerable, and occasionally to her own detriment, right? Maybe sharing a little bit too much. So I think my parents really put up some good guardrails early on, and we had as normal a childhood as we could have hoped to imagine growing up in Southern Connecticut, outside of the having a connection with New York, but not being in Manhattan, and likewise not being in Los Angeles. I think that was particularly important to my dad, and I'm forever grateful to him for that, among many other things.
Was there a moment as a young child, though, where you first realized that your mom and dad were a big deal?
I would put it a different way. I would say there was a moment where I found out that who they were was not necessarily normal. For me, going into the city and going and watching a live studio audience where my mom would be taping with Regis, or particularly one Super Bowl where my father was calling the game and my mother was singing the national anthem.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
How many sons get to say that, right? Getting to go into the booth with my dad. I've got some great photos here of where I'm holding a little action figure. I'm probably like 5 or 6 years old. And I think my dad was, whether it was in, so I think Miami, this particular one, I have to go back and check. He did so many of them. Almost a silly little anecdote, but one thing steps out. I remember getting in an argument when I was really little with one of my friends saying that my dad could pick up the house if he wanted to. Just stupid, like what kids say, right? My friend was smarter than I was. And he said, you're a knucklehead. There's no way. And I remember his dad came to pick him up from our house. And we were having a play date. And my friend at the time looked at his dad and said, Cody says his father can pick up the house. Can you tell him that he's mistaken? And my friend's dad looked at him and said, you know what? Cody's probably right, actually.
Oh, that's great.
I just remember feeling so vindicated. It was really neat to see my friend's fathers revere my father in a way that they would not revere maybe other peers, right? And my father was certainly older. You alluded to it. He's 59 when he had me. And, you know, I had an older dad, but he was also always available to me because of that, right? So he did Monday night until 97, I think it was. So after 7, he was home. You know, he was the carpool mom. He was there. And that was the joke at school, is that it was all the moms and there's Frank Gifford.
Did he have the actual time to coach some of your sports teams?
He never wanted to coach because, God bless him, he never wanted his involvement to overshadow whatever we were doing. And I had asked him too a couple times. He would go to every game. He was always there, but he would never talk to the coaches. He would be friendly with them, of course, but he would never offer advice. And he would never, and they would ask. You know, of course they would ask. He never wanted to get over his skis. Just a great man. I miss him. Miss him a lot, as you can probably tell. Never gets easier. Fun to talk about him though.
Who was the disciplinarian in the house? Your dad or your mom?
Certainly wasn't my mom, because the one and only time she ever spanked me, I looked at her, I said, is that all you got? But my dad, he had this look, right? He would never hit you ever, but he had this look where if you don't shape up, there's going to be a problem. And if you even wanted to test the waters a little bit more than that, he would just grab you by the arm in a way that was never actually endangering you, right? Never going beyond that line, but enough to just let you know that he dominated you. So he's got these mitts, man. He's got these paws that are like a bear. He's just massive hands and he's broken every finger and they're all gnarly. And they're all, forever in my mind, they always smelled like firewood because he was constantly building a fire, sticking his hand in the fireplace and not having feeling on the tips of his fingers because from however many times they've been stepped on. So he would grab you with these big mitts that smelled like cedar wood or something. And you just knew you better get your act together. So it's going to be hard for me to replicate that with my two boys.
You're talking about missing your dad. What do you enjoy most, watching the film of his playing days or watching him in the booth at ABC on Monday Night Football?
Oh, definitely the playing, definitely the highlights, because that to me, there are fewer of them because again, it was his career was coinciding with just that birth of TV. And what highlights there are I think almost exclusively, maybe not, but I think virtually all of them are in black and white.
Yeah, sure.
So there's this like mystical thing. Every time I watch him, you're like watching almost this ethereal, otherworldly thing going on. And his movements are just so, it's just inherently more dramatic to watch someone run with a ball than speak with a microphone too, right?
He was so graceful in open field. He was almost like a gazelle. Watching those films is just, it's great. It's magical seeing him in action. And if I thought for viewers that didn't have the opportunity to see him in action, he is, I guess the player that I would most compare him to today would be Christian McCaffrey.
Yeah, probably, which is a great compliment. My dad would be thrilled to hear you say that. He would say McCaffrey's a better player than he ever was. I promise you that.
Your dad would, because he was overly modest. And I've got the McCaffrey jersey in my closet because I'm a Niner fan. So I revere Christian McCaffrey, both on and off the field of play.
He torched us at Stanford.
Oh my God. I was at the game. I still visualize it now because he's coming down the sideline on that pass and he goes for 50 yards. And he tore us up. If we switch gears now and talk a little bit about the darker side of the game, your dad once said that pro football is like nuclear warfare. There are no winners, only survivors. Can you tell us a little bit about the award-winning film that you produced, which is Requiem for a Running Back?
I executive produced it, and it all credit and all plaudits go to my friend Rebecca Carpenter, who directed the film, and her friend Sarah D, who produced it. I really came along late in the game and just helped move it along with my friend Chris Borland, another 49er, by the way. And the gist of it is that Becca made a movie about her father, Lou Carpenter, who was a great player for the Packers. He was never a superstar, but he was a great player for Vince Lombardi. And he then went on to coach with Vince and coached in a number of positions in the NFL for many years. And football was his life. And by extension, it became the life of his girls, his children, and his family. And they were a football family. And when Lou passed away prior to his passing, in some ways similar to our own situation, where more families than you'd probably like to know or admit, Mark, but the older these guys get, the more these symptoms seem to manifest in terms of the relationship between traumatic brain injury and cognitive behavioral issues. Anyway, Lou, before he passed away, started behaving a little bit erratically. And this was a man that really had his head on straight for all of his life and was a giant in his field and was a very put together, diligent, smart person who basically started to unravel. When he passed away, his family, I think largely spearheaded by Becca, but I don't know what the committee was like in the family at the time, but they made the decision like we did to study his brain and just get a sense of trying to understand what was going on. And that was the first time, I forget what year it was, that they got his results back, but that was the first time that they had ever heard of CTE. And it clicked for them, like it does click for a lot of families, where you say, holy cow, this was not a character defect. This was an injury that had been sustained playing a very violent game. So Becca, being the great filmmaker that she is and the great creative mind that she is, herself a Harvard rower, really smart cookie, and she went on the road to interview other people who might help inform what she was going through and help to really better understand the relationship with her own dad. And she brought a camera along, I think at the encouragement of Sarah D, the producer, and they basically traveled all around the country talking to a lot of really interesting people about this topic. And they did a first cut of it a number of years ago and really clicked with a lot of people and got absolutely rave reviews from everywhere, from the Hollywood Reporter to Sports Illustrated. And the first time I saw it was at UCLA, just as a friend of the court. And I was sitting there, I actually brought my girlfriend at the time, then fiance and now wife, mother of my two boys. And I was holding her hand. And I remember my father flashed across the screen at one point towards the latter third of the movie. And I just remember crying like a baby. And I just remember thinking, holy smokes. And I'm just watching it thinking, this is strikingly similar to what the very end of my father's life was like. My dad was really blessed in that the pathology for him was mainly about concerning his memory and his hippocampus. But so he did not have any of the other sort of hallmarks of this disease with aggression or anything like that. The guy was the happiest, the most content human being on planet Earth, but he had very evident problems with his memory at the very end of his life, which at the time, passed away a week before his 85th birthday. One could attribute that, not knowing any better, to age-related whatever, right? But it had preceded that for a number of years, and we were all cautious about it.
I'll also put the link into the show notes as to those three different options to watch the film. I would highly encourage all football fans, all sports fans to watch this film. Off mic, we were talking about the other notable Hollywood-produced film that came out in 2015, and that was Concussion, starring Will Smith. Both of these films, to my mind, should be watched by all football fans.
And I was saying to you earlier, too, that Concussion, as effective as it was, it's ultimately a dramatization, right? There's going to be that distance between the viewer and the filmmaker, but in Becca's case, these are flesh and blood people, and they're the families. I think what's so poignant about it is listening to the testimonies of these, particularly the women and the wives that have gone through this with their husbands who have suffered this illness. And it's just heartbreaking. You can't watch this movie if you have a heart and not have it be touched by it, because it's the same story over and over again, but it manifests in uniquely different ways for different families. But what was so great about Becca's approach to it was that she, like us, we still love football. I don't think there needs to be any sort of cognitive dissonance to say that you can love football, but also still respect and fear the perils that are inherent in this game, right? So my position very simply is that football is a great game, but it's not a game in its tackling form that should be played by children. There's no reason for it to be played by children. When John Madden was asked, how long does it take for a kid who didn't play Pop Warner football to acclimate to tackle football in high school? How long does it take? What's the learning curve like? You know what his answer was? He said 2 weeks. A good athlete will pick it up in 2 weeks. So let's weigh that on the opposite hand. If you start a kid at 5 years old or 6 years old playing tackle football, they're going into high school at what, 14? So you could shave 8 years of the cumulative aggregate effects on a young brain and on a young neck and on a young kinetic chain through their whole body that is not built biologically to withstand the force of that energy going into the brain over and over again. It is the height of lunacy. And people, particularly youth coaches, just a lot of them don't want to hear it. A lot of them are set in their ways. That's fine. It is what it is. I had disagreements with people who are still on my side of the fence about it, whether or not it should be legislated against. I'm fairly libertarian when it comes to that issue. I don't really like the government telling me what to do, and I don't like telling other people what to do. Part of my thing is, a part of our families really, because we did it with our family, is wanting to get the information out there so people can make a more informed decision about what they do with their children.
Right.
So that was really our North Star with being involved in the project and in the commercial cut of the film, was to say, look, this happened to us. My father, whether he's on the Mount Rushmore of the NFL, he's up there among the stars.
He is.
His name means something in that game. And this is part of his story. And our hope is that it's part of his legacy too, that if he can keep just one kid out of hurting his brain or becoming paralyzed or having any sort of cognitive problems because they started football too early, that would be a win for us. So I think we've already, in that respect, probably got a W on the board.
I think you're right. And you touched on so many issues there. I think about it as a dad too, because our son started playing full gear, but flag football in third grade. And even at that point, now he's 31, so this was a few years back, that was a hard decision for my wife and I to make as to whether he wanted to play or not. And I think on some level, we were hoping that, okay, let's get it out of his system now. And maybe he doesn't want to come back and play full tackle fourth grade, but he does. And he's on the smaller side. So he plays up until sophomore year in high school. And I can still remember as a dad, we're watching lacrosse at his high school. And he's like, Dad, I think I'm going to give up football and focus on lacrosse full time. And as a dad, I didn't want to express my joy audibly, but inside I was like, oh, thank goodness.
Yep.
It's interesting too, with flag football coming into the Olympics in 2028, hopefully that intensifies, because that's another alternative version of the game that's less dangerous. I would applaud you as well with the thought that maybe it's seventh grade that kids start playing tackle, or maybe it is held off until high school. Now, even in high school, you have, I believe, three concussions while you're playing for Greenwich High back in Connecticut.
So I had two in 1 week going into the season my senior year, which was a real bummer, is an understatement, because that whole month is a little foggy, frankly. But I hid the first concussion, which that's on me. I talked to my dad about it, but he was from the generation where I remember distinctly, he said with no animus, he just said, what do you want me to do about it? For him, it was, you got your bell rung and you set out a series and then you go back in, right? That was, and by the way, to you, Mark, and other parents who did make the decision, I started playing tackle football in sixth grade. My own parents put me in sixth grade. I'd like to be very clear too, that I had there's no criticism on my part of parents who do make that determination. Certainly no criticism of those who have done it prior to all of this knowledge becoming available.
Right.
I do think there is a responsibility. I mean, I'm a parent myself and I've got two little boys. I do think now there is a responsibility. If you are going to put your kid in any sport, there's a lot of studies coming out about the dangers about hitting a soccer ball over and over and over and again. I just wanted to make that clear, that I'm not trying to sling arrows at anybody. Parenting is the hardest job on planet Earth. Our hope is that we can make that one decision a little bit easier for people.
You were talking about your two concussions in that single week senior year. And I think that's human nature for young athletes, especially boys. I think the nature of it is to say, I'm going to tough it out. And if I am honest with my coach, I may not play. And what I'm about is playing right now. So I'm just going to shoulder through.
Yeah, the trouble is the brain is the mechanism that makes that decision to pull you out. So if that's compromised, you have a problem.
Great point.
So I remember, you can see me on it, was, again, it was preseason. I did it in practice. And then I ended up playing in one of our scrimmages before the season. And you can see me on the tape. I make a couple tackles and then I go over to the wrong sideline. And nobody plucked me out of that game. And I couldn't pull myself out of that game. The problem with having a second concussion in the same week is something that's called second impact syndrome. And if people don't take anything out of this podcast, this particular episode, please do look up what that means. Second impact syndrome is when your brain has not had the chance to fully heal after an acute injury, and it is re-injured because it's potentially fatal. I don't want to be inflammatory or hyperbolic about it, but it really is. Every year you read about kids dying on the football field, and I would say 9 times out of 10, it's likely attributed to having a second impact when the first one was either undiagnosed or underdiagnosed. You're playing with fire doing that. So stupidly, I had my second in that first week. And the conventional wisdom at the time was to take, I think it was 10 days off and monitor it and whatnot. And then I moved from free safety to tight end. I played the whole season at tight end. I had a third when I got tackled in practice at the end of the season and my helmet snapped against the ground. The ground is sometimes your worst enemy, particularly for quarterbacks. You saw it with Tua. You see it with a lot of guys. The neck will never compete with the G-force that a 270-pound edge rusher is bringing, running full bore at you. No neck on earth is strong enough to withstand the force of that whiplash. So your head snaps against the ground. The energy is transferred from the ground into the cranium, into the skull, and then the brain is sitting in cerebrospinal fluid, which is moving around, and your brain is rattling on the inside of your skull, which has ridges and is not perfectly smooth. And that causes shearing, axonal shearing in the axons. And you get really bad inflammation and a host of other problems that if you don't rest it and allow the brain to heal on its own, which oftentimes it does, thank God, most of the time it does. But if you jump right back into action, you're really setting yourself up for problems in the short term and the long term.
I think you've hit on one of the key points. I think one of the areas where we're so much wiser today is in this zone and knowing that young athletes do have to take time off if they have experienced a dramatic brain injury, a concussion. And I think coaches now, even I'm back coaching Little League Baseball, and even I had to take a concussion training course in order to be sensitive to it. And baseball is not one of those ripe sports for concussions, although things can happen. So I think that's great. Now, when you think about the college game, pro football, do you believe that it's safer today than when your father was playing when it comes to head trauma injuries? Players are clearly faster, stronger, and bigger. We're wiser, but in essence, the game is so much more fast-paced.
That is such a good question. My answer may be a cop-out, but we'll take this in two steps. In the professional game right now, guys are compensated so well for what they do. The economics have changed considerably. And you asked about safety. And I mentioned earlier that I'm in a lot of ways very libertarian on this issue, so long as people are educated about it. Who am I to say to a young man that is about to, if he's going in the first round or second round, get a $10 to $20 million contract? You shouldn't play football and you shouldn't be able to take care of multiple generations of your family if you steward that money wisely because of this prospect of potentially doing damage to your brain. That doesn't answer the question, but I think it helps inform the question, which is that is the question matters most to people that are going in the league right now. It doesn't really matter whether it's a hell of a lot safer or just a little bit safer. It matters that there is still an inherent risk and there are degrees of risk, just like anything in life. The reward is so much greater now, materially, financially speaking, than it was when my father played. The whole calculus has changed.
This might be a tough question to end on, but Boston University did a study recently where they examined close to 400 former NFL players who had died and their families had given up their brains for research. And it was ascertained that 90% of those former NFL players had CTE. The NFL is trying to walk a fine line here, Roger Goodell specifically. He says, yes, we have donated $100 million to research. I'll lead off. I clearly think he needs to do more. I think this situation can't be fully mitigated until it's recognized that it is a huge problem for athletes and more money is directed towards the Players Association and for care after retirement. There's a multitude of things embedded here, but if you were commissioner for a day, what would be some of the things that you would do to make the situation safer for players when it comes to trauma?
Oh man, that is such a good question, Mark. Again, I don't want to skirt it, but I think it's such a tough job. And I know Roger, and my father was very close with Roger, and I respect Roger. He's got a big problem on his hands. We all know that. And the bigger problem is what families like those in Requiem for a Running Back have to deal with on the personal side. I would not pretend to know what the answer is. And I wouldn't pretend to be as educated as he is on the details of various insurance policies and medical policies and whatnot, because I haven't needed to be in a number of years because my father is no longer with us with retirement benefits and the like. I can just speak to the fact that if you look at the market cap, if you look at the aggregate value of all 32 teams, and you look at the cash flow, and you look at those balance sheets, and you look at the staggering amount of money that is generated by this product, none of it is possible without the players. None of it. And those are not the players that are just playing today. It's the players that played 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, and prior to that. And it's the players that will be playing in the future. And the pipeline is changing because people are starting to delay, like yourself, delay tackle football longer and longer. And the economics of it are changing. people that don't have to play football the way that some from different disadvantaged socioeconomic backgrounds are thinking twice about putting their kid in contact football at sixth grade. I would, again, without knowing the actual figures, I'd have to be awfully ignorant to think that I have the solution when I don't have all the data at my fingertips. I would say that it is critically important to invest as heavily as financially possible into the lives of current former players before it is too late. And I don't want to get into the details of the settlements that have been reached and some of the criticism of those, because again, I'm not an attorney. I am the son of a great man and a great football player. And our whole thing as a family, and I'll speak for myself too, which is how do we protect this game and how do we protect the people who play this game? Because ultimately, I care more about people, just like my father did. Care more about people than I do about a game.
I think that's beautifully stated. And to some degree, the game has become almost a gladiator sport, and the gladiators themselves need others to help them out, whether it's the Players Association, whether it's us as fans. And I think some strides have been made positively. I think much more has to be done. I was talking to my son earlier this morning. He's, hey, are you excited to be talking to Cody? And I said, yeah, definitely. And I think I'm also going to do a couple more episodes this year on this subject, because we're not going to be able to cover all the intricacies associated with CTE and head trauma and the like. One of the companies I've invested in along with my wife is called Nestry, and their founder is great. And they're all about helping with the aftermath. The founder had 7 concussions when he was playing football in his days. And there are some things now through science, through neuroplasticity, that can clearly help those that have had trauma. And there's some products out on the market, one of which I know you're involved with. Collar is another one, which basically is a collar that a number of athletes are now using that helps increase blood flow to the brain, which then serves as some mechanism for reducing the likelihood of serious head traumas.
That's Dr. Bales's product. Julian Bales, I believe, came up with it.
Which is great. Final question. So you do have 2 young boys.
I've got 2 little monsters, big monsters.
So my guess is they're not going to be playing youth football, but when it comes to high school, and if they come to you and say, Dad, I want to play, what's your answer? What do you and Erica say?
I get goosebumps thinking about it, because on the one hand, for me growing up, I lived and breathed it. And if someone were, my father did not want me to play football, and he certainly did not want me to play again after all my concussions. And yet, when I slid the practice schedule across the table on my 21st birthday and I surprised him having made the team, he looked at me and I don't think I've ever seen such pride in his eyes. That's the great irony of this whole thing, and fear at the same time, because he then right after that kind of knew what that meant and in the context of what I had gone through. So with my boys, it will be flag football. I would love to coach them flag football, and we can bring out my whole SC playbook and we can have a lot of fun with that. I've kept it just for such a time as that. When they get to 14 and they're freshmen in high school, I think I want to see physically where they're at. I want to see scholastically where they're at. And I would, at the time, pray to God, I hope I make the most informed decision at the time. And I pray that some of the products that we as a family have invested in terms of mitigating that energy waveform going into the brain, whether it's reinforcing the helmet shell or looking at therapeutics like you described, I pray it's a different chessboard by the time they're 14 and that I can make the best decision. I'm not closing the book on it, but I'm not going to have my son point to a podcast a few years from now and say, Dad, you said I could.
I think that seems like a wise and reasoned answer there. Cody, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your father and the amazing work that he did, not only on the field of play, but in the announcing booth, and the work that you are doing here to shed further light on the impact of CTE. It's commendable and it's much needed. And again, as I mentioned in the show notes, I'm going to highlight the links to Requiem for a Running Back and some other information for those that want to delve further into the seriousness associated with CTE. But thank you so much. Fight on.
Awesome, man. Thank you. Fight on. Appreciate you.
Thanks to Cody for revealing such personal and engaging stories about his father. Frank was a great player, gifted announcer, and kind, generous, and caring man. Perhaps most importantly, he was also a loving husband and father. Now, I know that CTE is a daunting topic, but I admire the work that Cody's doing to shed awareness and provide recommendations on how to address this tragic condition. And I do encourage you to watch Requiem for a Running Back. This film brilliantly highlights how CTE can wreak havoc on athletes and their entire families. In my show notes, I've included a link showing the movie viewing options. The second impact syndrome Wikipedia link is also noted. If your son or daughter does experience a concussion, please seek medical attention immediately and avoid rushing them back into competition. I've also included links to video highlights of Frank on the football field, talking about his days on Monday Night Football and the thrilling Franz Klammer Olympic race. Off mic, Cody was kind enough to give me a detailed video tour of his father's amazing trophy and memorabilia cases. That ranks as one of my personal podcasting highlights to date. Cody also read the letter that the New York Giants owner, Wellington Mara, sent to his father after Frank's initial retirement caused by a horrific hit from the Philadelphia Eagles' Chuck Benarek in 1960. After the vicious blow, Frank was unconscious for 36 hours, spent 10 days in the hospital, and 18 months in recovery. Undaunted, Gifford would return to the field and become the NFL's Comeback Player of the Year in 1962. As you've now heard, Frank overcame a myriad of hurdles in order to become a football icon. In his own words, the greatest victories in life come after the biggest challenges. I'll leave you now with the heartfelt words that the NFL owner, Wellington Mara, penned to Frank.
So we're talking February 9th, 1961. So this is after he retired the first time. Dear Frank, I didn't get a chance to speak to you yesterday to tell you personally how much you have meant to me and to the Giants. You were with us at both ends of the rope, and no player ever did more to bring us from the bottom to the top. From the moment you joined us, I never knew you to be anything but the top. I never knew you to do anything in public or private that did other than reflect credit to yourself and to us. We have had and will have other fine boys and other great players, but I don't think there will be any who could so completely combine the epitome in both. We all wish you the best. You gave nothing less. You are nothing less, and you deserve nothing less. As always,